Hi, today is Thanksgiving in 2020, and we have a really, really small family gathering. My name is Trish Martinelli,
I'm Carol Woodruff.
and we are friends and family to two amazing people that we're going to interview today. The first is my boyfriend, James Anderson, and the second is his mom, Mary Brickell. And today we're here to talk about Mary's father and James's grandfather. So, Mary, I'm going to turn this over to you to say hello and who you are, and maybe when you were born and when your father was born.
Hi, I'm Mary Brickell, and I was born April 3rd, 1958. My father, James Russell Brickell, was born September 18th, 1930.
Okay, and James, now you.
My name is James Anderson. I am General Brickell's grandson. I was born on February 3rd, 1993.
And Mary, can you talk to us a little bit about what you see here on the table?
Right now, what we have on the table is pictures of memories from the early part of my life with my father, where I was either not born or up until around the age of 7.
And James, can you talk a little bit about what is kind of special and cool that you pulled out of your grandfather's memories?
We have a lot of photos here on the table, one of which is when his F-4 Phantom was shot down in 1963, I want to say. I think that's when he came down. And we also have his sidearm when he was a pilot, of which I invested a little bit of money into to find out the special story that came from it.
And I'm going to take a moment to read something that's really cool. It's an old parchment, a legal size document from the President of the United States. And I'm going to take a moment to read this out loud. To all those who shall see these presents, greeting. Know ye that reposing special trust and confidence in the patriotism, valor, fidelity, and abilities of William Henley, Henry Brickell, I do appoint him inspector in the service of the American National Red Cross with assimilated rank of captain in the Army of the United States. To rank as such from the 31st day of October, 1918, he is therefore carefully and diligently to discharge the duty of the office to which he is appointed, by doing and performing all manners of things herein to belonging. And I do strictly charge and require all members and agents of the American National Red Cross under his command to be obedient to his orders as inspector. And he is to observe and follow such orders and directions from time to time as he shall receive from the authorities of the American National Red Cross or the officers of the Army or Navy who may be set over him, according to the rules and discipline of the American National Red Cross, is engaged in assisting the armed forces of the United States. This commission to continue in the force during the pleasure of the President of the United States and of the American National Red Cross for the time being, given at the City of Washington, D.C., this 11th day of January in the year of our Lord, 1919. Signed by the President, the Secretary of War, and the American National Red Cross Acting Chairman of the War Council. And Mary, why is it that this particular document was so special and you set it out for us to discuss today?
Well, because as with all the documents for the family, I am the keeper of documents. And this is one of which that takes me back to time prior to my father. And it's an important document, historical document, and it's important to me and important to my family.
Was there anyone who had ever filled this role of inspector for the American Red Cross?
prior to William Henry, not that I'm aware of.
Oh, that's great.
Not that I'm aware of.
Right. Understood. But this was very special, and this was something that your family has passed down as a special memory.
Right. And it was special enough to pass it down to me.
Right. So, James, can you talk to us a little bit about some of the, kind of aircraft photographs that we're looking at today? Describe to us what you're seeing and what's in the pictures.
So, during his career as a pilot with the United States Air Force, before the Air Force was actually a thing, the Air Force was a department of the Army, he flew what's called an F-4 Phantom. And while he was flying the F-4 Phantom, I believe it was over Pyongyang, where he took a anti-aircraft ordnance.
Was that in Vietnam?
Yes.
How many photos are you looking at there?
I'm looking at three photos of the fuselage of his aircraft when he was effectively shot down. I'm not sure how far away from his base, but he managed to land the aircraft without crashing. In his office, for as long as he lived, he kept a small piece of the shrapnel encased in plexiglass as a more or less gentle reminder of the incident.
And his office, where did he work?
This was during his retirement, and where was this in Virginia?
Well, he kept the shrapnel in his office in the Pentagon.
Oh, okay.
And also when he was in...
So he stayed in service after this.
He stayed in service after that, and then also he had it in... he was in the Pentagon, he was at Bowling Air Force Base, he was at Fort McNair.
Yeah.
And so he would serve tours of duty at different stations. We would travel and we would come back, and we would travel and we would come back. But from all those different offices, the shrapnel now is with his oldest son, Russell Brickell.
And when you say we, can you describe to us a little bit about the family of General Brickell?
Yes, it was myself, my older brother Russell Brickell, my younger brother Bill Brickell, my mother Marjorie Brickell, and my dad.
Okay, great. So you were the only girl out of all of those siblings?
Living.
Okay. And can you tell me more about that?
They had a series of deaths of young children in their life, and we have cemetery plots of two young girls, babies. And at that time, it was something to bury miscarriages or full term. And so I was one of the three girls that they had that survived.
Was that something that you always knew growing up, that you had sisters that had passed away?
Russell Brickell. Yes, I was always very aware of that.
Okay. And okay, James, you touched a little bit on how you had gone a little bit of an extra mile to find out about your grandfather's sidearm. So you can you tell me a little bit about what you're looking at right here, and maybe even do a little bit of the
sound
effects for the people listening, and tell us what you're looking at and what you learned when you kind of did that extra research.
So what I have in front of me here is a Colt Pattern 1911 pre-A1 pistol, chambered in 45 automatic Colt pistol. It's been in the family for literally generations. It's currently my mother's handgun, and I have taken the serial number, taken photos of this, and it has been used for the CPCA, the Colt Pistol Collectors Association, as a educational tool for determining the authenticity of early model Colt pistols, including magazines, determining what's called the reverse patina to determine if it's original to the pistol. And when I went the extra mile and I spoke to Colt, and they have a program where if you pay $149.95, they'll actually tell you the history of the firearm. And the unique
sound
history,
effects.
Yeah, sound effects. Everybody loves sound effects. the unique history of this pistol when he was in the Air Force, it was his sidearm as a pilot. He had to surrender it, and it was used in service by other soldiers at the time. However, it was found in Fort Dix, New Jersey. It was not in my grandfather's possession at the time.
When was it found at Fort Dix?
I don't have the exact date.
Ballpark?
I can't ballpark it. Okay. I need to have my documents out, which are in my email. However, prior to his retirement, he traveled to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where this firearm was being held. In the service, he had his card that had the serial number of the exact firearm that he had, and he tracked it down to this armory in Fort Dix. So he traveled up to New Jersey, went and spoke to the master armorer and said, I understand you have this sidearm in stock, you have this serial number. He had the original holster that he carried, the original belt,
wow,
three magazines.
That's cool.
And the .22 LR conversion kit that was used at the time to train soldiers.
Of which you couldn't hit anything with.
No. Of which we still have it. It's upstairs.
Yeah.
And when my grandfather walked into the armory, there is a written account.
Great-grandfather.
I don't have...
No, it was your great-grandfather, her grandfather, yes?
It was my grandfather who took this from Fort Dix, New Jersey. Because a three-star general walked into the armory to retrieve the pistol, and when the armorer said, we need professional orders to release this, a man said, I have 1, 2, 3 stars. There's your orders. Give me the pistol.
And who was that?
That would be his grandfather.
Okay, that was his grandfather.
Amazing.
So yes. Mary, can you talk to us? You've got about a dozen photographs laid out here. And if you could maybe just kind of step through briefly what the photographs are, and then we'll have a chance to discuss a little bit more about the pictures that you're looking at.
But I also want to kind of close the loop on the chain of custody of the weapon that James was talking about, and that is back in 1988 or so. I had moved into an apartment building, and I lived on the bottom floor, and my father had determined that that was not a safe place for a young lady my age to be, and he gave me that pistol with everything, along with hollow point bullets, and he said that'll stop them. And so that was it. That was my stopping weapon for anybody that came in. I never fired it, but I had it when I was in my 20s.
In case you needed it.
In case I needed it. In terms of the pictures that are here, I am the keeper of documents for the family, and this is just what was pulled out from the top layer of many boxes that I have, and they are pictures of our younger life. There's a picture of my father with my mother very young, right when they first were married. But what's special to me is the picture of my father with his 20-06?
That is a 12-gauge shotgun, in which we have upstairs, actually.
And then also, you can't see it, but he had a .44 on the other side, and he had a sombrero, and it was my brothers and myself when we would go hiking in New Mexico, and my father was Chief Ugg at the time.
Chief Ugg?
Chief Ugg.
Say more about that.
We called him Chief Ugg because he would always say it was a beautiful day, and we would go out and we would get rained and we would get hailed on, and it was because Chief Ugg knew nothing of the weather.
Mm.
And so that was, we grew up always being outside.
Yeah.
We grew up, we went hunting, we went fishing, we got chased by animals, we swam downstream against our will, and it was all Chief Ugg, and he always was armed and ready to protect us.
All right, so say a little bit more about the other photos that you see in front of you.
There's a picture of my father and my mother and my two brothers and myself, and sitting on a sofa with a print of, it's an Asian from Vietnam. It looks like a rubbing of some sort. And that was kind of the decoration at the time. More picture at the dining room table. The dining room table where my mother and my father, I took the picture, my two brothers are there. And that dining room table, your Uncle Bill has. Bill Brickle has that table now. There's a picture of my father when he was young and a friend of his, and they were on they were sledding.
It reminds me a little bit of A Christmas Story.
Well, it does. They grew up in Vermont. There's another picture here, and that was our house in Friendswood, Texas, where that was the first house my father ever bought. And he, I think at the time, paid like $12,000 for
it. What were you doing in Texas?
Dad was with the was with NASA at the time. He was also one of the designers for the landing module. And he also was so he was with NASA, and he was also with the Air Force. Dad wanted to be an astronaut, and he was one of the shortlisted astronauts for the training program, but he was too tall.
Shucks.
He couldn't
how
get in.
How tall was he?
I think he was 6'3", 6'2".
And how tall is your son?
6'2".
Yeah. So it still runs in the family, yes?
Yeah, they're both spiders.
And what else do you have there?
Okay, so there we are hanging off the back of a station wagon with the I don't know what they call those fins.
RV?
Or
maybe?
No. This was a station wagon back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, no seat belts sitting on the back. And then this is a cabin in New Mexico where Dad would go hunting. We had no running water, no electricity. Dad would go hunting, and we would go play and look for chipmunks and other animals to play
with.
And
what's this picture of the deer here?
And
the one that you have right there.
And that was part of the family vacation, is that we had a cabin in New Mexico with no, as I said, no running water, no power. And Dad would go out, and he would go hunting, and he'd come back, and he would string it up. And then that's what you do. You let the blood drain out of it and everything, and that would be our venison.
So he was dressing a deer there that he had caught.
He was hanging a deer. Yes, he was. And that was frequent on our family vacation pictures.
So he was a good hunter?
Yes.
Excellent.
A good shot, too.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
And James, can you tell us a little bit about some of these other pictures? Are you familiar with the ones that you're looking at?
Well, I can look at the pictures. I can more or less have a vague grasp of who's in them. For example, I'm looking at a picture of my grandmother Marjorie Brickle and my mother Mary Brickle, and this appears to be in their Texas home, correct?
Mm-hmm. Easter.
I have a picture of my grandfather from what it looks like to be in the academy prior to the. Prior to the actual branch of the Air Force being a branch separate from the Army.
I think that was Naval Academy.
That was Naval Academy?
Yeah.
Okay, so when he was with the Navy.
So he graduated from the Naval Academy?
There was no Air Force Academy, so
right,
he graduated from the Naval Academy.
Okay, great. Do you know when?
57, I think. Because then he went into the War College. I have his Army bag. I have his yearbook upstairs.
But that's where he went to college.
Was the Naval Academy, yeah.
Okay, very cool.
Yeah. More pictures of Chief Ugg and his family walking down a path.
This is the one with the sombrero.
Correct, the one with the sombrero.
In Vermont. A sombrero in Vermont?
No, that was the cabin in New Mexico.
Okay.
That's the same place where you see this picture of me. We had one of those, what do you call those furnaces?
Just an indoor fireplace.
Wood burning.
Yeah.
Wood burning, but there's a name for a stove top or whatever.
And my mom is sitting in a chair reading Good Housekeeping magazine.
And I couldn't read at the time. It was only like 4 or 5.
Okay, and what about these photos here?
This is my mother with my brother Russell. And I was a baby in her arms. And the German Shepherd that the family dog that we had, her name was Val. We had German Shepherds for a long time.
Uh-huh. And how about the picture right under it?
This is my brother, younger brother Bill. And for a while, my father was stationed in Alaska, mm-hmm. and we were there, and this is one of our spec homes we were living. And there, gosh.
When you say spec home, what does that mean?
Means that they had just a series of homes, so one looked just like the other. There, you know, you could walk into your neighbor's home and be the same as your home, right. And everything. The fun thing about that is there's a cat there in the little girl that lived next door to us. And we had one of those laundry chute there. And not a lot of houses had laundry chutes. So we made a basket for that kitty, and we used to, like, transport her up and down through the laundry chute, whether it would be with her against
approval
her
or not.
Will.
Yeah. And that's the final picture. What have you got there?
Well, that is in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And that is my older brother, Russell, and my younger brother, Bill, William.
Right.
Who is standing off to the side with his ukulele. And
wow.
He loved his ukulele. And there's a picture upstairs of Bill and his ukulele and sitting next to me on a chaise lounge in Texas. And the ukulele did not last much longer than that because he took it and walloped me over the head. So there's a picture of that upstairs. And that was the end of the ukulele.
So if you can, like, draw a timeline from when your father graduated the Naval Academy to when he retired, can you kind of walk through that a little bit? Like, Dad served here, and then we moved to Texas, and then we moved to Alaska, and then we were here in Northern Virginia, and he retired. Do you have any kind of, like, timeline like that?
Not accurate, but
talk to me a little bit about his retirement.
Dad retired. We were living in Alabama until 1970. I graduated in 1976.
Uh-huh.
He came up here from Alabama and was at the War College and at Bowling Air Force Base. I think he retired in the 80s and he went to go work for UTD.
Uh-huh.
And then he was with them for a while. I don't know if at any point in time we want to, you know, insert the fact that he had Parkinson this whole time.
Oh, I did not know that. When was he diagnosed?
He was diagnosed. It was known that he had it a lot longer than what he was diagnosed.
Right.
Because he was a general officer and they did not want to admit that their general officers had Parkinson's.
Right. So this was a whole different time and different era. Maybe the 60s. 70s.
No, well, the government then acknowledged that Parkinson's and other afflictions were a result of Agent Orange exposure.
Ah.
And so my father, when he flew in Vietnam, he flew out of Udon Air Base in Thailand.
Right.
Which they deforested with Agent Orange. And so he it was finally acknowledged that Agent Orange contributed to the affliction, but they wouldn't acknowledge responsibility because they said, well, he did not fly, you know, the pilots were in the center of the airbase. And then it was then determined, no, they had the barracks on the outer perimeter. And so they acknowledged that in his last year or two of being in a nursing home, that they acknowledged responsibility for that.
Wow.
And I think a lot of my father's accomplishments and his contributions have been deeply clouded by the affliction of Parkinson's.
Wow. Do you remember how old you were when you knew that your father had Parkinson's and what that meant to you at the time?
There were other things going on at the time.
Sure.
And he had a lot of stressors in his life. And I do remember when, even before I was married in 1991, he had been diagnosed and he was divorced. And then right after his diagnosis and divorce, he remarried his wife that he stayed with him with until he died.
His original wife that he had been divorced
from? Not my mother.
Oh, okay.
Not my mother. He married the other Mary Brickle.
Got it.
They got a divorce and he remarried her. And then they were together until his death.
Okay. And James, can you talk to me a little bit about maybe your earliest memories of your grandfather?
Earliest memories of my grandfather would definitely be running around causing a muck in his home in Great Falls, Virginia. Great Falls, correct?
Mm-hmm. Herndon.
Herndon, Virginia.
Herndon.
He had a rather large home in which he lived in with Mary Brickle, not only Mary Brickle as in his wife at the time. And it was a large home, great place to grow up and run around in. And he would always be tinkering in his office behind his computer or looking at old photos and paperwork in his office. I'd go into his office. He'd have models of the F-4 Phantom, the Apollo 11 aircraft, the fragmentation that shattered the wing of his F-4, and just plenty of things for a young boy to look at and play with. As far as his Parkinson's, I don't have too many memories of my grandfather before Parkinson's. However, it wasn't until the very end where it would really take a toll on his life.
Do you think that his tinkering kind of affects how much you tinker and fuddle around with things? Like, aren't you kind of a little bit into gunsmithing? Yeah. And do you think that there's a connection with your grandfather?
And things that go bang, like yes. The ice cream.
Uh-oh.
So my mother had always told me a story about how my grandfather may or may not have been involved in a certain fire in which engulfed an ice cream factory.
Oops.
Yeah, this has neither.
Yeah, granddad was
been confirmed officially.
He was a young explosive / detonator or whatever when he was younger. And he, you know, I think back in the day, I wouldn't even say they were Model 8s or whatever they would have, but he would put gunpowder and combustibles in little potholes or whatever and watch the cars go over them, or Model 8s or whatever you want to call it, and
yeah,
kind of see them get a little lift. a little lift in their booty. And then he also had a little bit to do with something that happened with an ice cream factory that's been family lore for many years. I will say that James only knew Parkinson's.
Yes.
Only knew Parkinson's from when he was a baby in his carrier. I used to take him over to his granddad's because his dad lived a mile from here.
Yeah.
And I would help his dad with his granddad with things. And James would start off, he was in the carrier on the counter.
Yeah.
Then he was the toddler. Then he was the young boy. Then he was the young man. And
did you see a special connection develop between James and his grandfather?
I did. Yeah, very much so.
How would you describe it?
Well, James was so similar to his grandfather. That and his grandfather, you know, when James get in trouble, his dad would just giggle and smirk, and loved the inquisitive, brilliant mind of his grandson.
So getting back to that idea of how you tinker and gunsmith and, you know, just kind of fiddle with things.
I've always had the unique ability to take anything mechanical apart into however many pieces that is composed of. I want to say recently in the past decade where I've been able to actually put them back together, which is...
That's the best part of it, right?
Well, it's quite fun to take apart, but it's good to be able to put it back together. That way we can take it apart again. I did end up taking a few classes and certifications in gunsmithing, being able to take apart anything that can go bang and put it back together. Turns out people are willing to pay for your services, and of which I'm deeply grateful for. I used that as part of my career for about 4, 5, 6 years. And my grandfather's pyrotechnics side hobby, him as we'll call it.
So there's a story about granddad. And you know, James used to get in just trouble. little bits in trouble here and there, but
as a chemist,
no, and also as a kid, yes. but it was so reminiscent of what your grandfather and his nature, and one of the things that James did was we would go over there for Halloween, and mm-hmm. somebody would show up for trick or treat, and the next thing you know, there's like a little piece of their uniform or their little costume missing, and there's just James standing like, what did he do with it? Where did it go? We don't know. But
if you were to imagine that your father was here today with us, what would he say to James, and what would he say to James's children yet to come?
Yeah.
What would he say to James today?
I think my father was always a troublemaker.
Uh-huh.
And I think he would encourage James's free mind and encourage him to find his way. But he was also very much a stickler for education.
Uh-huh. Very strict.
And very strict.
Extremely strict.
And always a gentleman. And I think he would want to impart those values and that the way he thought about that. And he was always very proud of James. He just loved it when James pulled some of his shenanigans.
Yeah.
And I think that anything that James did and I did, he would like to see that magnified times four
yeah.
in your children.
Yeah.
There you go. You deal with it now, dude.
Yeah.
All right. Now, the next one is for you, James. If you were to imagine that you were your grandfather looking at your mom, his only daughter, what would he say to your mom about how he feels about her and her life?
You deserve your son. Yeah, you earned this.
Yeah. Do you think he felt a special connection with his daughter?
More so than the other sons? Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no other connection greater than a father and his daughter. But, my mother was not completely innocent of shenanigans either in the family. So I was not the only tinkerer in the family. Turns out my mother has had a few missing things around the house that got found with taken into. Weren't you the one who stole your brother's watches and clocks
Uh-oh.
And took them apart in a million
pieces?
No,
you got that backwards.
Okay, and I'm backwards. Wondering if okay. maybe Carol has something to say.
It looks like Carol has
about young Mary and about how she got into shenanigans.
I will say this. Mary and I have known each other since the 80s, and she has been just this wonderful friend who also... I will say this about her. There is nothing that Mary Anderson can't do.
Right.
Whatever she puts her mind to, she's amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
From what you know of her father, what do you see of her father in her today? What do you think her father would say to her today if he were here?
I think he'd be really proud of her.
Yeah.
I mean, I only knew General Brickell. I mean, I got to know him a little bit, and he was always a kind person to me. But I know he would be very proud of his daughter.
Aww.
Yeah.
I know what Dad would say.
Okay.
Dad would say, you know it, and I know it. That was a dadism. You don't know it, but that's how he'd say, you did that. No, I didn't. Yeah, you did. You know it, and I know it.
Aww. And do you think it like went to meaning also like you're awesome, I know it, and you know it?
No.
This is when he knew somebody did something.
That's yeah. when he knew he did something.
Yeah. Are there any other like specific memories that you can think of that really stand out? I mean, I know that you and I, when we drive past the Air and Space Museum, you're like, my grandfather has a special corner in that museum.
Yes.
So is there anything else like really special about when you think about your grandfather that if you know, you could tell me about him that I wouldn't know?
My grandfather, there's two air and space museums in this region of the country. There's a few out west, but towards the east, you have one in Northern Virginia in Chantilly, and then you have one in Washington, D.C. At the one in Washington, D.C., my grandfather actually has this small little nook. It's about 6 foot by 10 foot, where it has some documents that he had that he signed. It has his old belt, canteen, compass, uniform. And it's on permanent display with the Air and Space Museum of America, as it was called then. Now it's just the Air and Space Museum, where people can learn about his past.
It's called Looking at Earth. It's on the section on reconnaissance, the early days and times of reconnaissance. And there's also a picture of him standing next to his plane that mm-hmm. was had the blowout on that he brought the film back. And he's standing there, and he's got a cup. And it's a little one of those little triangle cups that you get from a water cooler. Uh-huh. But it was filled with Mission Joy juice, which at the time was on your, you know, when you returned successfully, it was actually Crown Royal.
Of which you will not read about in any book. No. But that's what happened.
All right, so James, maybe the last question for you. If you had an opportunity to sit down with your grandfather and you knew it was the last conversation you'd get a chance mm-hmm. to have with him, what would you say to him?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm not exactly sure what I would say to him. It would probably be one of those, I would ask him about his childhood and his history, and these questions that we've been asked today, I would ask him the same questions about his father and his grandfather.
What would be important for you to tell him before he goes?
I'd just say I love you. That's mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. And Mary, same question to you. If this was a conversation that you were having around the kitchen table with your father today, and it was the last chance you had to talk to him, what would you say to him?
I've already been there.
Yeah.
Yep.
I already had that.
Yeah.
That's it.
All right.
That's all I'm going to share about that.
Got it. Sure. Fair enough. Well, that is it for my questions. Mm-hmm. Unless you guys have anything else you'd like to add about General Brickell.
Can you edit this?
Oh.
Nope.
Okay, then that's it.
I got something I want to add.
Okay.
One of the more recent favorite memories. General Brickell loved his drinks, so to say.
Okay,
he loved his red wine. He also loved his beer. Now, when he was in nursing homes, he was not allowed to have any alcohol, any red wine. None of any kind.
We used to bring it to him with a straw.
We would sneak in bottles of beer and miniatures of wine.
Ain't happening.
Yeah. He would get snuck an afternoon drink whenever we came by, and It was the thrill of smuggling in contraband into Falcon's Landing. Falcon's Landing.
Right here. Or in Tampa, also.
It was just one of those things where when he would take a sip of it, he would suddenly become cognizant of what's going on around him. He'd say, "Oh, I know what that tastes like. I remember this. I like this." And mm-hmm. then at that point, the dementia would just fade away for just a few seconds. That was nice.
Yep. Smuggling beer in.
Mm-hmm. There's a story for later about the straw that I'll share.
Sister with a long straw.
But I would like to say that, you know, when I was honored to attend General Brickell's service at Arlington Cemetery, it was a truly unique experience. But also the fact that when many of his colleagues and other people got up and spoke about him, you learned about this impressive, unbelievable career. And I think that's where you kind of wish you had the chance to have known that sooner, so that you could have asked him a lot more questions about what it was like to do what he did back when he did it.
Yeah, and I, you know, when you talk about conversations, the Parkinson's had ravaged him so much that I don't think I talked to him the last 10 years of his life. He couldn't speak.
Oh, that's
and
hard.
So there were, but we did have those
end
of life conversations. But I think one of the last times he ever spoke to me was that his wife's nephew was a kicker for Syracuse.
How fun.
And I remember coming down, and he was living in Sarasota, Florida. And I went in, and it was cold. And Dad was in a wheelchair, and he was just in his wheelchair. And I found the Syracuse sweatshirt. I put it on. And I came into the room, and he looked at me, and he's just staring at me. And he's staring at Syracuse, staring at Syracuse. And I said, Dad, it's really cold. I want to wear this sweatshirt. I hope you don't mind because it's really cold. And he said, I really wish you hadn't have done that.
Oh, no.
And that was like, that. I think that was the last thing he ever said to me.
So, my.
But it was like, I really wish you hadn't have done that. I was like, what did I do?
There was also the fishing trip where we carried him onto a boat.
Oh, yeah. He has... my brother, Bill, his son, was one of the, I guess, the people, the frogmen type of thing. He's a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
And when we were in Sarasota at one point in time, and we would, that was one thing that Dad always told us. Wherever you are, you go fishing.
Yeah.
And I've always been a fishing person. Everywhere I've ever lived, everywhere. And every time we go down to see my father, we always fish. And we were going to get Dad out on a tour of the Sarasota Bay. And so his nephew, Adam, was able to just pick him up and do a dead man carry and carry him into the boat and take him for a ride.
Could you tell whether or not he enjoyed that trip?
Oh, he did. And, you know, he had a cold beer with a straw. Yes. He was good.
Yeah.
Love those straw stories.
Oh, this, yeah, well, there, you know, finally there's a sister with a long straw.
Ah.
And Dad lived about an hour from here as a crow flies, and he had a wine cellar.
Ooh.
And I was over there with James or with Nott almost every day helping, doing something, whether it be cooking dinner or scrubbing the hot tub or doing whatever, because... I just wanted to help, and so I would come over and I would do that, and then, you know, we'd have some wine, and I'd take whatever's left of the bottle home with me, and my brother would call, my dad would say, your sister, the one with the long straw, was here today. So I'm forever known as Long Straw Sister.
Long Straw Sister.
Mary of the Long Straw.
Mm-hmm. Long Straw. Great.
All right, just maybe 2 minutes left. If you had one sentence to tell him before we sign off. I mean, I know that we kind of talked about that again, but just one last sentence, just maybe, and I love you, Dad or Grandpa, what would you say?
I would say, Dad, I love you, and you're a good father, you're a good patriot. I'm sorry that you suffered and that you suffered at the hands of your government.
Yeah.
I would just say I love you. That's it. Nothing to it.
Okay. Well, this is Thanksgiving 2020, and we've had a fantastic conversation about General Brickell with his daughter and his grandson. And we'd just like to say, in this time of uncertainty, that love matters, regardless of the generation, regardless of the time. And that it's important to tell those people that you know that you love them in the time that you have with them. Bye.
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 So now I'll tell you about the penis queen.
Oh, okay. I hope that was.